This is Conversations in Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, it's April and Congress still hasn't resolved last year's budget, and another deadline looms large. And the political process in Washington has swung into high gear over which programs should be cut and to what extent. And there's uncertainty at this point as to whether Democrats and Republicans can come to an agreement on funding the government. President Obama has called the House and Senate leaders into the White House, trying to avert a government shutdown. And then again, we're looking forward to the 2012 budget battle, and it's kicked off this week. The GOP Budget Committee Chair Paul Ryan has proposed a rather ambitious plan, which he claims will save $2.2 trillion from health care over the next decade.
Well, Mark, that certainly was a headline-grabbing figure. $2.2 trillion from healthcare over the next decade is certainly very substantial. And, of course, it was inevitable that some of those savings would come from repealing the Affordable Care Act. Congressman Ryan and his committee estimate that that would save $1.5 trillion and certainly be consistent with what the majority party had said they wanted to do.
Well, these are numbing figures, and there's going to be a lot of reconciliation of these numbers. And burning of the midnight oil is going to be happening at the Congressional Budget Office. Because remember, Margaret, under the Affordable Care Act, they actually said that we would save $210 billion over the next 10 years.
That's right. And the plan that's being put forth, as we understand it, also calls for medical malpractice reforms with a projection that that would save $43 billion. And you'll remember that a lot of people didn't feel the Affordable Care Act went far enough to introduce medical malpractice reforms to the system. But the real surprise to me, anyway, called for major changes to Medicare, which I thought was the third rail and nobody would touch it.
Well, there have been a lot of private groups who have been saying that Congress needed to stand up and address these issues. Certainly, Representative Ryan has in his proposal, whether or not it gains traction. Well, one of the items is that he wants to increase Medicare eligibility and raise the age level to 67 years of age.
That's right, which tells us all that we should enjoy what we're doing because we're going to do it for a long time. And he's put forth a plan to privatize Medicare for those 55 and younger starting in 2021. So really, this affects the next generation of seniors more than today's. It would call for premium support in which the government would pay only a percentage of the total insurance premium for seniors, with more help for low-income and sicker people. And just like private insurance works today, if you want better coverage or more comprehensive coverage, you could kick in some more money.
Here at Conversations on Healthcare, we'll be keeping an eye on Representative Ryan's proposal and the entire 2012 budget process as it impacts health reform. Clearly, one of the issues in terms of saving money will be the conversations that are going around the country about improving patient safety and effectiveness.
That's right. Patient safety saves lives and saves money. And today's guest is a national expert in that field. Dr. Lucian Leap is internationally recognized for his efforts in advancing patient safety. He's known as the father of the modern patient safety movement, and his body of work includes the landmark 1999 Institute of Medicine study, To Err is Human, which prompted the medical community and legislators to find ways to improve patient safety. We're so happy Dr. Leap can join us today.
But no matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows on our website, chcradio.com. You can subscribe to iTunes to get our show regularly downloaded. Or if you'd like to hang on to our every word and read a transcript of one of our shows, come visit us at chcradio.com. If you're a social media aficionado, you can become a fan of Conversations on Healthcare on Facebook and also follow us on Twitter.
And don't forget, if you have feedback, email us at chcradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Now, before we speak with Dr. Leap, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, for the headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. House Budget Committee Chair Paul Ryan's 10-year budget blueprint has been officially released. The proposal is designed to rein in Medicare and Medicaid spending while squeezing trillions of dollars from the nation's deficit. The plan makes fundamental changes to Medicare by converting the entitlement program for the elderly into a premium support program where the government would spend a specific amount for beneficiaries' care. Congressman Tom Price from Georgia spoke at the unveiling and said in addition to changing Medicare, the proposal would also repeal President Obama's health care overhaul.
This budget repeals and defunds the government takeover of health care so that we can advance patient-centered health reforms. And this budget reflects an honest assessment about the current unsustainable trajectory of Medicare and saves the program for future generations.
The Republicans' 2012 budget proposal stands little chance of becoming law, since it would have to be approved by the Democratic-controlled Senate and signed by President Obama. The Senate has voted to repeal the unpopular tax reporting requirement in the health care law, widely referred to as the 1099 provision. The measure had few backers from either party, yet a months-long battle ensued over how the repeal would be paid for. The measure now goes to the president, who's expected to sign it. The much-anticipated Accountable Care Organization, or ACO, rules for Medicare have been released by CMS. The Medicare Shared Savings Program, as it's officially known, would allow providers to band together as ACOs starting in January of 2012. The ACOs create an incentive for healthcare providers to band together and form a network to coordinate Medicare patients' care, with the end result being improved quality of care and cost savings. The 429-page proposed rule is just a draft that now enters a 60-day comment period for the public and interested parties to weigh in.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Dr. Lucian Leap, one of the nation's leading figures in patient safety, widely known as the father of modern patient safety movement in this country. Dr. Leap is currently adjunct professor of health policy at Harvard School of Public Health and chair of the Lucian Leap Institute at the National Patient Safety Foundation. Welcome, Dr. Leap. Began your career in pediatric surgery and came into health policy later in life. You credit Dr. Howard Hyatt, a pioneer in patient safety, most widely known for his work on the Harvard Medical Practice Study with guiding you in this direction. What were your earlier years like when you began in this field, and what else has influenced your work?
Spent 25 years as an academic pediatric surgeon and decided to go into health policy work, and Dr. Hyatt invited me to join the just beginning medical practice study. So this is a very different experience for me. This was a big population-based record review study. We looked at 30,000 patient records in hospitals in New York State. And what really struck me after we had done all the work and got the data and analyzed it were two things. One is the extent of injury, of patient harm from treatment was much greater than I had ever realized as a practitioner. You don't see these things very often in your everyday practice, but when we, looked overall at a sample of a large sample of patients, it turned out that one in 25 or 4% had an injury. But what really struck me was that 2/3 of those seemed to be due to errors, which we could tell just looking at the record. So I was suddenly impressed with the fact this was a much bigger problem than I'd ever realized before.
Dr. Leap, in reading some of your work, I can see your real interest and passion for changing the culture from one of shame and blame, as it's sometimes called, to looking at the breaks in complex systems that really led almost inevitably to the error happening. Could you tell us a little more about how systems theory works in healthcare when you apply it to this issue of patient safety?
Sure. This is really the driving concept behind the patient safety movement. I refer to it as a transforming concept, the idea that people make mistakes. It's not because they're bad people. It's because they're in a bad system. And this was brand new to us back then, 15 years ago, because we had all been trained in medical school, and same for nurses in nursing school, that if you learn your lessons, do your homework, and keep up and are careful, you won't make mistakes. Well, it turns out you have to do all that, but that doesn't keep you from making mistakes. And so there was an immense body of knowledge, cognitive psychology, human factors engineering, and that sort of thing about the fact that errors are induced. They're caused by defects in the system. And the corollary of that, which of course is the point, is that you can change the system, you can change the processes of work to make them much less error-prone, to make it much less likely that you will make a mistake. And that's the concept behind the systems change. That is, as Don Berwick likes to say, every system is precisely designed to produce exactly the result it gets. So if you don't like the results, in this case, harm to patients, then change the system. I happen to think that's true. People say that's extreme, and there's still a human factor, and there certainly is. And we do have problems with people that have not kept up or have competency problems. But those are systems problems too. What's the system you have for making sure that people were properly trained and are maintaining their skills and so forth? So this idea that if you want to improve an outcome, look to the process, is very fundamental for safety and for all of quality improvement, and has really proved to be very useful. I mean, it works. We do it, and it makes a difference.
Speaking of Dr. Berwick, you were a member of the Institute of Medicine's Quality of Care in America Committee, and you helped write the famous To Err is Human in 1999, which stated that medical errors kill up to 99,000 patients per year. And that prompted the medical community and lawmakers to find ways to improve patient care. And a few years later, in 2001, the IOM published Crossing the Quality Chasm, which offered a set of performance expectations for the 21st century healthcare system. What are some of the areas you've seen progress in on patient safety since the call to action became more widely adopted?
Well, there have been several areas that we've seen substantial strides. The first thing that comes to mind is medication use. We prescribe 3.5 billion prescriptions a year in America. And doctors make mistakes, pharmacists make mistakes, nurses make mistakes, patients make mistakes in using medicine. And so there's been a tremendous amount of attention devoted. Some of our first studies, the first study we did to try to see if this systems theory worked was on the medication systems. And so there's been a lot of work on improving medication systems. A simple thing we did, now it must be almost 10 years ago, was to remove hazardous drugs from the unit as medicines that if you accidentally gave them would be fatal. Mm-hmm. You have them down in the pharmacy where they can mix them and take care of them. So medication safety has been one area. Another has been, we had an early interest, but a lot of other people as well, in computerizing patient records and computerizing the order system. So that you order a medication on a computer instead of writing a prescription by hand. This has immense potential to improve safety, and it's just taking forever to get it implemented. I mean, finally, the Obama administration appropriated $30 billion to move electronic medical records into doctors' offices. I think the other area has been we've become much better at patient identification, making sure we have the right patient for the procedure or the medicine or whatever. You go into a hospital now and it seems everybody's asking you your name and your birth date.
That's right.
But that's good. Yes, that is good. That's a good thing. And so it's a nuisance, but it's a good thing. And then there's been a lot of attention in the last few years on preventing infections. Infections are one of the most common types of adverse events, and infections are one of the big ones. And we've had a lot of improvement in that area. There's bloodstream infections, pneumonia, surgical infections, et cetera. So I think there's been a lot of good work and a lot of improvement. Not nearly enough, though. I mean, we still have a long way to go.
Dr. Leap, many institutions, certainly like the Institute of Medicine and your own institute, the Lucian Leap Institute at the National Patient Safety Foundation, are hard at work on this issue of advancing patient safety. And there are also the very well-known, to those of us in healthcare anyway, figures like Dr. Peter Pronovost, who's been a guest on our show, who created a breakthrough but very simple intervention using the checklist to reduce those central line catheters that you were speaking about a moment ago. And I remember when we spoke with Dr. Pronovost, the good news was that hospitals that had rigorously adopted this had reduced their central line infections down to near zero. And the bad news was that not every hospital had adopted what seemed to be so obviously an effective intervention. So I guess my question is, has patient safety at the hospital level or large healthcare organization level moved into the executive suite, the corporate suite, the board suite, or is it off still on a sideline in quality? Would a board of directors expect to hear a report on errors in patient safety the same way they would on the financials of the institution these days?
That's a great question, and I take it to heart because I happen to sit on a board of directors of a hospital, and I'm sort of the local nudge about this. But the short answer is not enough. And first of all, let me step back and say what I think Peter Pronovost's work has been absolutely path-breaking. It's one of the it was the first demonstration that you could completely eliminate a certain type of adverse event. People always said, well, you can reduce them, and if we do a better job, we'll have fewer of them. And the whole idea in safety, of course, is to have none. Peter's work, particularly in Michigan, where he got them to implement a protocol for preventing central line infections and also a protocol for preventing pneumonia in people who were on ventilators. And he had 68 hospitals that went 6 months without a single episode of central line infection or without a single episode of ventilator-associated pneumonia. That alone, with those hospitals, saved over 1,500 lives. And so I can't speak too highly about Peter's work, and I'm glad you had him on your show because it really changed the conversation about the improvement to eliminating adverse events. The problem is that most hospitals still aren't aboard. And if you look at the healthcare systems that have really, really made great strides in safety, and I think of Virginia Mason Medical Center in Seattle, Cincinnati Children's, I think Geisinger in Pennsylvania and some others, the hospitals that have made a big difference are those that have the full support of the board as well as the leadership of the CEO. The question for those of us that work in this is how do we get every hospital to do that? And we haven't figured that out yet.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Dr. Lucian Leap, one of the nation's leading figures in patient safety. I want to pull the thread a little more on mandatory reporting, which has mostly been in the purview of the states. Do you think there's a need for a federal system of regulation? Talk to us a little bit about the role Medicare might play, or should it be left up to the states and hospitals? And along these same lines, what can regulators do to learn from various states and encourage safety and quality and innovation?
Well, I think that last question is the important one, and that is why report? What does it have to do with safety? Let's start with the fact, and that is that only half of states require reporting. So, if you say you think this is essential, it's quite evident that leaving it to the states doesn't do the mm-hmm. job, and that's an argument some people have used for a national system. But the important question is, what are we trying to accomplish? When you look at the state reporting systems, and some of them are very impressive. I think Pennsylvania has an outstanding system, for example. They get tens of thousands of reports. And so if we were to have a national reporting system, we would get, over 1 million reports a year. And as soon as you say that, you then can immediately understand the obvious question, which is, how do you process that? The only reason to report is if you can learn from it and make changes to prevent something from happening again. In order for it to be of value, they have to do an investigation to try to understand what went wrong and try to figure out what might be done about it. Without that kind of investigation, which the term we use is root cause analysis, really trying to understand where the system broke down. Remember, it's not bad people, it's bad systems. Okay, what were the bad systems? And so that takes time, money, expertise, etc. Without that, all you're doing is getting a count. You can say at the end of the year, well, we had 5,000 falls. Well, that's nice to know, but now what? So meaningful reporting requires meaningful analysis. That has to be done at the place where the injury occurs. It has to be done in a sophisticated way, and that information then collected and put together. This is a huge job. What we really should do, though, is have a better way of sharing those learning.
And I couldn't agree with you more about the value of those root cause analyses in primary care outside of the hospital as well as in hospitals.
Right, right.
Now, your institute has identified six areas of focus that require system-level attention if we're going to move this national patient safety agenda forward. And for our listeners, I want to go through them for a moment. They include medical education reform, and by that I assume you mean all health professionals, educational reform, engaging consumers, transparency, integrating care, the safety of the healthcare workforce itself, and also the restoration of joy and meaning in work. And that last one, the restoration of joy and meaning in work, really stands out to us. It's so rarely discussed in healthcare. We certainly talk about it in primary care as fundamental to maintaining that vitality and energy and compassion over many, many years of caring for patients. But perhaps you could elucidate the relationship as you see it between patient safety and restoring joy and meaning in workforce.
We've been talking about burnout in nurses and doctors. We've been talking about doctors retiring early, nurses quitting, and et cetera. And in too many of our healthcare institutions, we have a toxic environment, and it's just has grown that way. We sort of haven't changed the way we practice in 50 years in a fundamental sense, but medicine has changed dramatically, and as a result, puts tremendous strain on people. And so our hierarchical nature of healthcare, where what the doctor says goes, that doesn't fit anymore. The big lesson of the last 10 years in patient safety is it's not enough to have good safe practices. It's not enough to have checklists. It's not the checklist that makes patients safe. It's the teamwork that it takes to put the checklist in place. It's the teamwork it takes to implement these safe practices. And teamwork is almost a foreign language in healthcare. We don't learn it in medical school. It's fair to say in many, if not most hospitals, we don't have the kind of collegial team collaborative working arrangement that's essential. And as a result, the physicians and the nurses and everybody are under increasing strain, and it has literally sapped the joy and meaning from their work. We think it's an absolutely critical thing. We've already had one roundtable on this. We're going to have another, and we'll be publishing a white paper with some very specific recommendations, which I'm hoping will address this.
Dr. Leap, we'd like to ask all of our guests this question. When you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovation, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
Well, it's interesting because innovation is almost has to be the daily work in quality improvement and safety. That is, healthcare workers need to address specific problems they surface in their work and then develop an innovative solution for it. Massachusetts has a mandatory reporting system for serious reportable events, and they report the results once a year. You know what the number one adverse event is in hospitals? Mm-hmm. By far, falls. Mm-hmm. People falling. Huh. Well, we ought to be able to prevent that. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on. And so there's a lot of work being given to that, and I think there's some innovative thinking there. And of course, then technology marches ahead, full steam. I mean, I was a surgeon for 25 years, but I made incisions in people and sewed them up. They don't do that anymore. They operate through these little tiny scopes and mm-hmm. with robots. And so nobody can predict where that's going to take us, except it does pose new problems for safety that we have to address.
Today, we've been speaking with Dr. Lucian Leap, one of the nation's leading figures in patient safety. Dr. Leap, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives.
This week's bright idea focuses on a program that improves the way asthma is managed in children. The Cambridge Health Alliance, an integrated healthcare system in Massachusetts, wanted to take a more proactive approach to reducing the number of children who use the hospital emergency department for asthma-related treatment. As is the case around the country, asthma is one of the leading causes of ER visits for children, particularly low-income children, and one of the major reasons for missed days of school. And certainly, the data shows that with better management, these consequences can be prevented. But at the most fundamental level, the Alliance's Childhood Asthma Program is a community-based model of care. Teams of community health workers with registered nurses make home visits to help parents reduce or eliminate some of the asthma triggers. They outline an individual asthma action plan with regular steps to prevent or treat asthma attacks. And another key element is the patient registry, so that the child's asthma information is available whenever he or she enters the healthcare system, be it the primary care office, the school health center, or the emergency room. The asthma program has dramatically reduced hospitalizations and ER visits for children in Cambridge. Annual asthma-related emergency visits fell 50% from 2002 to 2009 for children enrolled in the program. An approach to pediatric asthma management that's moving away from reactive treatment to aggressive daily management through an integrated system of care that includes every place, the home, the office, the school. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.